With your permission. And just a quick introduction. So I called my wicked stepbrother, who's sober for a long time in Los Angeles, and he said, there's this guy in Santa Barbara. He's like my best friend. You could call him. He gives a great talk. And I said, I will. And so I called, and he very graciously accepted. And so we're looking forward to hearing you talk tonight. So please, without any further ado.
My name is Matt Johnson. I'm an alcoholic. And it's not as wicked, it's his bastard stepbrother that lives down there. He's a Chris. And I don't think it was that gracious. I'm not, you know, it's like I'm always happy to be asked, and but always reluctant to participate. You know, I don't know what it is. So, about me. I am happy I got to bring a couple of guys I sponsor up with me, and they were forced to listen to me for a whole hour all the way. And they got one question in each, and I was able to fill most of the blanks for the whole time, right? Like, hey, do you like this song? And then I would just turn it down, and so, no, we had a fun time. And it's great to see Billy. I've known Billy now for 20-something years, and gosh, we go back, and I gave Billy some direction when I got the sponsor. I said, find a newcomer to work with. And he found a guy named Dan. And Dan's been sober now 18 years or something like that. It's fantastic. So, you know, it's always nice to see. And I've known Dennis forever through Chris, but I never really knew you. So I can't wait to get back.
You still don't. My name's Derek.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's right.
We're gonna have a good
one. All right. So, well, I don't really have, all I got's a canned pitch, so I'll just get right into it. So let me break that baby open and get going, right? So I come from a normal family. Both my parents were alcoholics. I was raised around the L.A. area. I was a real sickly kid, sickly and accident prone. And, you know, I'm like one of those guys that I couldn't walk down the street that I wouldn't step in glass or get bit by a dog or... I'd run across the street. I got hit by a car when I was 7. And the only reason I'm alive is because it was a 1957 Volkswagen. And I crushed the fender and the hood when it hit me. It threw me against the curb and it broke all the ribs on this side, you know, kind of stuff. So, I mean, it was like, it's just like one of those things. Every time I turned around, it was something. And I had asthma real bad and hay fever, and I was given shots of adrenaline until I was old enough to swallow a pill. And then they put me on that stuff called Tedrol, which is kind of an amphetamine. But it actually kind of makes me feel like how I feel now, you know, where, you know, my palms would be sweaty and my heart would be pounding, but I'd be stuck in one place for about 40 minutes, you know, until that stuff came on. And then I'd be running around like crazy. And you know, so I took that. I'm also dyslexic, badly dyslexic, and ADD, or vice versa. You know, I couldn't read or write. I would go to school and I would open up the pages and the words would fly off the page, and it would be just like reading blank pages. I couldn't, you know, I mean, I could not read. And back in those days, in the 50s and the 60s, it was like, you know, you know, they would just say, oh, Matt's got potential, but he just doesn't apply himself. And, and like I said, I had ADD. I couldn't sit still. You know, I'd be like all over the place. And, you know, if he wouldn't just fidget around, if he'd just sit still, you know, and I just couldn't. And so basically, I had hated school. And I would go to school, and I couldn't read or write. And I would look at my stuff, and I'd look at the person next to me, and I just wad it up and shove it at my desk, and I never did anything. And then whenever they had a test or something, I would have an asthma attack and just go home, you know, kind of thing. So, you know, I mean, I never did anything. We moved around a lot. And I remember going to, when I was like in seventh grade, I was in this new school, and I wrote a pornographic essay and got expelled from school, basically. And I ran away from home. I did all that, you know, I did all that kind of stuff. And I ran away. I got caught. And they took me to the chief of police of Torrance, is where we were living at the time. And the guy said, yeah, you're just going through puberty and everything's going to be okay. Don't worry about it. You know, you'd be growing hair under your arms and on your legs. And, And, you know, and I thought, and I don't know why I remember that, but that was the only thing I remembered, although I was a late bloomer. That was, you know, but they took me, the other thing they did is they took me to a psychologist who was a dream man, you know, who was a group therapy, you know, kind of stuff. We sat in there and we just talked about what was going on. But she was a dream analyzer. And I liked that so much, I used to make up dreams for her to analyze. You know, I just, you know, I mean, I would just like, I just liked hearing about me, and so I did that. But it also separated me from everybody else, and you know, it's always just, you know, different from everybody. I never, you know, it's like a fat, awkward kid who never fit in, you know, kind of stuff. And then, you know, the only thing that I ever learned, I started going to the school, and I got into sports, and that was the only escape I had as a kid. And my folks were, like I said, were always divorced. And I don't really necessarily remember my first drink, but I remember my first drug was when I was about 15, and I helped put away a fifth of scotch with two other guys. And you know, it was kind of like the answer. You know, I sat down and drank that scotch, and they both reacted differently. And one became puking drunk, and the other one kind of just regressed. And I was making a conversation to him, and I put this guy, cleaned him up and put him to bed. And then I finished it off, the rest of the scotch, and it was like, you know, it was it. And so I started getting loaded as often as I could after that, and which was periodic until I was like 16. And then I started dealing dope, and then I had it all the time. But you know, I mean, I just did not, I knew it when I found it, you know, kind of thing, that there was something about it. But I didn't know how to hard, you know, I didn't know what I had. So I was getting loaded. I got a job on the Redondo Beach Pier. And as a dishwasher, which was a great job. And then at the Christmas party, they had a Christmas party, and they had one head just like this one here, one men's room. And I went in there. We'd gotten there early and stole all the beer, kind of thing. And I just was drunk. And it started at 9, and by 8:40, I was sitting in the can in the only bathroom, and I could hear him going, "Hey, get out of there." But I was so drunk by that time I couldn't even get up, you know. And I finally just said, "You got to come in and get me." So they picked a lock and they came in, and they, you know, my friend, you know, they pulled up my pants and took me home. And I was living with my mother. My folks were divorced, and my mother yanked me in the house and called up my father and said, "Come and pick up your son. He's just like you," which was the big put down, because my father was your basic 2-quart-a-day vodka, you know, full-blooded Swede vodka drinker, you know, kind of stuff, who never talked to you when he was sober. And, you know, if you bumped into him, you just, we apologized, you know, kind of stuff. And then, you know, until he got drunk, and then he would go completely the opposite way. You know, he just, he just wanted to talk or something. I don't know. You know, it was like, you know, there's an old joke about Swedes. We were Swedes. There's, you know, the 6 Scandinavians get marooned on an island, you know, two Swedes, 2 Danes, and two Norwegians. And the Danes go, the 2 Danes go, "You know what, we'll design a boat, you know, for us to get out of here." And the two Norwegians said, "We'll build it." And then they turned to the Swedes and they said, "What about you guys?" And they go, "We've never met," you know, kind of stuff. We were never introduced. Because we just don't talk. And I have a whole family, a whole Swedish side of the family that's like that. You know, we just never communicated or did anything. He was just always drunk, my father, and to hang out with him was always punishment and stuff. But I moved in with him, and it was great. He lived in Hermosa Beach, and he lived from here to we're kind of in the back to the front of the building from the sand. And it was the 60s in Hermosa, and, you know, it was like the greatest time in the world. I learned how to surf down there, and I learned how to deal dope. I learned how to buy, you know, 25... I was buying kilos of pot for $1.25, and you know, we'd make 28 bags, four finger lids, and it was enough for ourselves, and we'd never clean the seeds and stems out back in those days. And you would think you were going to make money and never did, but you would always, you know, I always smoked a lot. And the other thing that I had is I never had a, you know, it's like if you don't ever read, then all you ever know is what somebody else tells you or what you hear on TV or whatever. And I never read, but what I listened to was a lot of music. And so I picked up all my mantras from what I heard, you know, and there was a great song out by Hoyt Thaxton at that time called Give Me Weed, Whites, and Wine, and Show Me a Sign, and I'll Be Willing. You know, and I mean, and I literally just took that on as my mantra. And I liked, you know, I liked amphetamines for the motivation. You know, I take those amphetamines and I was like ready to go. You know, you just become spontaneous. And I like that. And then, you know, when I start grinding my, you know, my jaws. And so I would drink alcohol just to kind of loosen up my jaws and give me a little spit. And then I like to smoke pot just to appreciate the arts, you know. So you can, you know, you can just go to a movie and, you know, and laugh your head off and think, God, this is the funniest movie I've ever seen, you know, until somebody behind you goes, hey, shut up. And, you know, kind of thing. So I just, you know, I mean, that's all I did. And really all I ever wanted to do was just really become, Neanderthal, really. I just wanted to be loaded enough where I just didn't give a shit about anything, and you know, and I was always big enough where people pretty much stayed out of my way, and it was, you know, I just liked getting out of where I was. I never wanted to be where I was, and those are the days. Now we got so much data input, but in those days you had KRLA and KHJ down south, you know, and I mean, and that was it. You just did that. And then you waited, and we got our, you know, we got four tracks and then eight track tapes and then cassettes. And, you know, so we would, you know, we would listen to those eight tracks and loops and Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Jimi Hendrix and stuff. But I just stayed loaded, and I was really in a great time in the surfing world. It's right when the went from longboards to shortboards, they, you know, and so I got into that, and I hung out with all the guys that did all the. They were kind of cutting edge. They were doing the shaping and the glassing, and I was so not into it. You know, I mean, I like to surf, but I couldn't tell you why I had anything to do with a surfboard. But I did like I was saying, I did like to deal dope, and that was what I did. And I just stayed drunk. I loved those great wines, you know, at that time, and I think they still have them now. But you know, I like Spinata and Ripple, and. And at that time, it was like I was saying, it was easier for me to buy a kilo of pot than it was to buy a bottle of wine. I could, you know, I had to stake out the liquor store, wait for somebody to look like Billy to come by, you know, and say, "Wait, give me a bottle of Ripple Red," you know, and I'd give him, you know, 37 cents, and he'd go, or, you know, or 50 cents, and get that bottle. And I said, you know, just, you know, I only liked Ripple Red because I had a bad experience with some Pagan Pink and some barbecue potato chips one time, and you know, where I, you know, just did kind of, you know, how you kind of slurry the side of the, you know, the cement there with the pink, and you know, so I just didn't want any. So I just drank a lot of wine at that time and surfed and did that. And around this time, my mother moved in with us, and my mother was your basic blackout drinker. She would have two scotches on the rocks, and she would literally blackout, and she'd turn into Linda Blair, you know, where her head would twist around. And she was kind of the crazy, violent, profane one. And she really was. I don't know if she was bipolar or what she was, but she was one of those ones where she'd start drinking, and then, you know, it was like, look for things to throw, you know, and, you know, like the lamp. Would put, you know, that lamp was pissing her off, it would blink or something, and she'd just throw the lamp and throw the, you know, so we would, you know, we would just duck a lot, but, you know, or she'd want to slap the, you know, run around, and so finally by that time, I'd gotten old enough to drive, and basically what I would do is I would just, my folks would go into these big, you know, crazy deals, and, I'd go take my mother's car, disable my father's car, and get in my mother's car, and I would just drive around and get loaded, and it was really just medicinal at that time. I really just, you know, would, you know, I'd drink enough or smoke enough pot just so that I could fall asleep in the front seat of the car, and I would park the car, and my mother would black out, destroy the house, and we had a little door like this, and if my father would do stuff like. he liked to play the same song over and over again. He'd get so drunk, he wanted to hear just this one song from Earl Garner or Duke Ellington or something, and he would play it over, record players, find that one little song, and then he'd ask my mother, what did you think of it? And she'd say, I'll show you. And she would just take the album and break it, and she'd, or take the needle and, the thing and just bend it straight up right in front of him. But she'd start breaking shit, and you would come back and you'd think, didn't we have something? And then you would just look down and you could just see the trail of broken parts that went out the back door. She would just throw it out in the back afterwards. So that's what we knew everything was. And I would just, basically I would just go and get loaded, and I'd sleep in the car. My mother would wake up. She'd black out, go to bed, get up, crack of dawn, and then go to work. And I would park her car out in the front. She'd find her car, open the door. My head would fall off the armrest, and then I'd go in and get a couple more hours of sleep, and then my old man would take me to school, and that's how I went through pretty much my junior, senior year. And I graduated in 69, a functioning illiterate. I had about a third grade education or reading ability, and totally unequipped. And the only thing I could spell was forklift driver. And I thought, well, I can maybe do that. I couldn't do that. The one thing I could do is break down measurements. They said, hey, do you know what the abbreviation to gram is? I go, or ounce? And I go, yeah, I do. So, but I never got those jobs. And I got jobs pumping gas and, in the movie business, right? Tearing tickets and things like that. So, so I would get those kind of jobs, and it didn't take a lot of thought or work or having to write anything down. And it was always my inability to read and write was always one of those things where I thought, if you knew, I always kept you at arm's length, because I figured once you knew me, you'd know I was a fraud. That I didn't have anything going on, and that if you knew what was inside of me, you wouldn't want to know me. And I always lived like that. And it's kind of funny now that I think about it, because it's not about what it's about who you are and stuff. But at that time, it was all about, the perception. And I always felt different, and I never felt like I fit in with anybody. And I was always amazed by the people that could read who would walk around and they'd have a book in their car. And I think, I never read. I graduated from high school. I told the guy next to me when I graduated from high school, I said, I never read a book. And he said, this year? And I said, no, ever. I never read a book. And I thought I had, I really thought I'd fooled everybody. I thought I'd always... I've always looked, it's kind of funny that half measure line in the, in chapter 5, half measures avail you nothing. We stood at the turning point. And I'm kind of like one of those half measure guys that I don't stand at the turning point, I camp at the turning point. It's like, because I just stay half measures, It's like, I'm in the, why put off the day which you can put off for 2 weeks? I'll just procrastinate as far as I can, and if I can get away with it, I'll round any corner or do anything I can like that. So I've always been that kind of a guy. My one of the other things that my mother was really into was suicide. So she was always trying to kill herself, and she could just never do it. I don't know what the deal was, but this one night I came home from a surf trip, there was a pile of clothes on the floor, and I thought, oh, we're moving. And I went to bed, and I got up the next morning, and it turned out she had gone crazy, in a blackout. She'd cut off all the sleeves and the pants off the shirts and off the pants and put them around the window and turned on the gas and went to bed. And then my dad came home after that, smelled the gas and turned it off, and he went to bed. And then when I got home, I just thought, like I said, we were moving. And because there was a pile of clothes. But the next morning we could see everything was, she had put it all around the doors and all, And so they took her to see that psychologist that I'd seen 8 years earlier. And that psychologist recommended a doctor who recommended AA. And they both went in 69. And they ended up both getting sober at the end of 69, beginning of 70. And they both stayed sober for till they died. But kind of stuff. My mom died after about 16 and my dad after about 30 years. But they got sober and they got into an active group. And, you know, they got my dad got Clancy for a sponsor, and everything changed in, you know, down there. And they moved out, and I was just in Hermosa Beach, just like getting loaded. And I took a couple of, I took a little bit of some geographics. I went to Texas. You know, somebody goes, hey, let's go surf the Gulf Coast. And I thought, oh, great. And we go down to Texas to find out they don't have any waves in the Gulf Coast except when it's like hurricane season, you know. And, you know, they didn't have any pot. You know, they prosecuted for a roach. And so, you know, I had long hair. I'm down there. And they have that stuff called Everclear, which is, you know, 190 proof grain alcohol, which, as Norm Alpe used to say, get you downtown right now, man. You know, it's like, you know, you just need a half pint of that stuff, and it's like, bam. And but, you know, so I just carried that around with me the whole time I was there. And this guy's mother asked me if it was necessary that I drink in the mornings, you know. And I thought, shit, I got long hair in Texas. It seemed like even the women wanted to kick my ass down there, you know. And I thought, yeah, let's get out of here, you know. So we got back, and I did that. And then I went to Hawaii. I'd gotten busted with a bunch of pot, and part of the deal was just to get out of town. And I got out of town. This is back in the good old days, right, or whatever, you know. So I went to Hawaii, and I got over there and went on kind of the ganja diet, where I was making about $100 a week. I'd buy $50 for the ganja, and then $50 for the food and beer. And then we'd smoke that ganja, eat everything in the refrigerator that first night, you know, our first two nights, and then the rest of the week we'd just eat oatmeal and drink beer, you know, kind of stuff. And I think I dropped. I was already lean, but I dropped about another 20 pounds. You know, I was wiring my pants up. And I finally called my dad. I said, I got to get out of here. And I was trying to, you know, I knew I needed to learn to read. And I was trying to read that book called The Hobbit. And then I was taking those little orange barrel. At that time, they had that little orange sunshine, you know, kind of stuff. And I was taking that, and a guy turned into the Hobbit right in front of me. I'm like, Sid, right? It was like, just turned into the Hobbit. I thought, I got to get out of here, you know? It was like, so my dad, you know, brought me Sid the Hobbit. And so my dad got me, you know, gave me back. But he, you know, started the old, you know, you need to get a job, get a haircut, get out, go to meetings. He wanted me to get sober. And I was still into this deal where, I'm not two quarts a day, you know, vodka drinker. You know, I don't take two drinks of scotch and black out. You know, I just, you know, alcohol and drugs was like an answer. You know, I would take those amphetamines and everything straightened out. You know, I would drink that wine. And I felt like, you know, I could look at you in the eye, and I would, you know, like I said, and I always wanted that pot. I thought, God, maybe this would be laughing, you know, grass this time, you know, and I just wanted it, and it was an answer for me. It was just, you know, because when I was sober, it was all gray, and so. I came back. I got a job at Sears in the tire department at, you know, for like $2 an hour and all the glue you can sniff, and you know, handling all the tire repairs. And I just, you know, it was right at 72, I was just staying loaded all the time, and they sprayed everything with paraquat, and you couldn't get any pot. So I stopped smoking pot, and I was always seeing stuff, you know, over here from all the amphetamines and everything else that I was taking. So I thought, I'm just going to drink exclusively. I just put down on everything that I was drinking. I was going to the bars, you know, where you order a pitcher and the glass is optional, you know, kind of stuff. You need to just drink right out of the pitcher. Wait for her to come ask you to dance. I was one of those guys that the more I drank, the more resistible I became, I guess. I don't know what the heck, you know, it's like I always went home alone. But, you know, so I, you know, I was just drinking. I was crashing cars, and you know, and getting arrested and blacking out and doing all the stuff. And I thought, holy Christ, I'm doing like, I'm turning into my folks. And my dad asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting. I mean, I don't think I thought, holy Christ. I just thought, oh, man, you know, it was like another accident, another, you know, it was like just another one of the, it just always seemed like a bunch of bad breaks, always. And my dad took me to a meeting. I met a man there named Art Cole who changed my life. He gave me his phone number. He said, call me tomorrow, kid. And, you know, he goes, if you want to change your attitude, you have to change your actions. I thought, God, what a never, you know, I'd never heard that, you know, because I'd always heard, you got a bad attitude, you got to do this, and you know, it's like, but I'd never heard it, you know, the way he said it. And so I said, okay, and I called him, and he started giving me actions to take, and I started feeling better, and I got sober. I kind of sobered up, and then I went out for just one, and then ended up so drunk I couldn't even, I never had that problem generally, but I couldn't even start my car and shit, and, you know, so I called him up, and I started going to meetings, and I stayed sober for 38 days, and then realized that I was only 21, and thought, what am I doing here? You know, it's like 21, you know, it's like, and it seemed like at that time, everybody was fat, bald, and wore glasses, had Lasix. So, you know, I mean, it was really, you know, in 1973, AA wasn't, you know, as hip as it is today, you know, kind of stuff, and, you know, I mean, it was really a different, guys like Tommy Whalen, right? So, and so I got drunk, and I went out and got loaded, and, you know, I hooked up with a buddy of mine, and he had a bag of pot and a six-pack, and next thing you know, I had a bud in one hand and a bud in the other, and, you know, it was like just going, and then 3 days later, I woke up stuck to a Naga hide chair, thinking, what am I doing? You know, I mean, this isn't it either. And I called up Art and I said, can I come back to AA? And he goes, sure. And I did. And now we have one of the guys I sponsor is a really funny line, or a line that I really like. And then, so I'm going to steal it here. But when I came back to AA, I wanted you to front me the steps. I wanted you to front me the promises, because I wasn't really sure that I really wanted to do all this shit. You know, and then I wanted to sit through this and to be part of this leopards, you know, club or whatever. You know, I mean, I felt like this, you know, I couldn't think of anything worse to be than an alcoholic and sit in rooms like this the rest of my life, you know, kind of stuff. You know, I thought, if you front me that stuff and if I can just come in long enough to get my shit together and then go back out there, because I really just felt like because I couldn't read, I was just missing out on something. Maybe there was something that if I could have read, I'd have known, or, you know, that would allow me to fit in out there and not always feel like such a loser all the time, you know, kind of stuff. So fortunately, I had an, you know, epiphany after about 6 months. And I came back and I kind of got active in AA. I had Carnitas tacos right before I got here, and they're playing hell on me. Is that on tape, Billy? I thought, I can't imagine doing this, you know, and I would sit in the back, and fortunately, like I said, we kind of had the high, you know, back in the 70s, was they had the craziest best speakers you had ever heard, you know, in L.A., they were these crazy guys, you know, Clancy, Norm Alpe, Chuck C., and, you know, I mean, Jack Turton, and all these funny, Charlie Vick, and John Ackerland, and these incredibly funny speakers, and they'd get up there, and they would make you feel like they would talk, and you would identify with their feelings, and you realize that it was kind of okay to be there. But there was this one guy, I mentioned him earlier, Norm Alpe. He used to say, if you hear a line you like, steal it. Give the guy credit three times, and then it's yours. You know, and I would sit in the back taking inventories, stealing lines, you know, kind of stuff, and think, you know, that's a funny line, I'll use that, and that's a funny, you know, or I like... But what happened inadvertently, as I started to identify, and I would hear these lines, and I think, God, yeah, that really applies. And I always remember this gal, Marion, talking, Marion Wallin. I don't know, you know all these guys? You know all these guys, right?
Some of them.
Bob. What did I call you earlier? Dave? Derek? Sorry. This woman talked about, I used to be standing on a corner and I would be running an excuse for just being there. You know, kind of stuff. And I identify with that because I always lived in excuses. I never, it was never just good enough that I was walking down the street or was going to 7-Eleven or whatever. It's like I had to have an excuse. And, just for living. And, so I inadvertently I sat back in the back and I got this thing I caught alcoholism, basically, is what happened. And we were talking about it on the way up, the difference between needing AA and wanting AA, kind of stuff. And I got to a point, and the other thing that I did is something I lucked out. I got somebody asked me to sponsor him really right away, and I was a terrible sponsor. My first couple of guys, this guy goes, I said, hey, self-supporting through your own contributions, you need to go out and get a job. And he goes, I always wanted to just live off my mother-in-law. He goes, that's all I ever wanted to do. That's my goal. And I thought, well, if it's your goal, all right then. The guy. Now the funny thing is, and this is the whole thing I think, and we were saying, is it God's will or what is it? Why do people stay sober? This guy's got, he's got 38 years now, and he has probably been a gigolo his whole time, But he got by, he's gotten by, and he stayed sober, and he's comfortable, I guess, kind of stuff. He's living his life, and far be it from me, and kind of stuff. But that's, that's the kind of thing. But I was thrown into service, and inadvertently, on the top of page 89, it talks about, nothing will more ensure sobriety than intensive work with other alcoholics. And it really is the truth. And it really, you can transmit something that somebody else can't, or a non-alcoholic can, to that person. And then the second paragraph is kind of like the great thing, I think. And it's to watch somebody make it, to get some time and start working with others. And to have the fellowship grow up around you. And now it's kind of, that's all kind of esoteric and it's kind of one of those promises, and you think, what are they talking about? You'll intuitively know things that you previously baffled, those kind of things. When you're 21 and you hear that stuff, I remember the promises and thinking, who gives a shit? I never cared. Same thing with character defects. I thought, I was 21 and I was, it's like, I didn't have any character defects. I still surfed, I didn't think I had, anything. It's like you actually really do need some life experience to really start appreciating your character defects, I think, kind of stuff. And but I hung in there and I started doing the stuff. I learned how to go to work. I learned how to wake up to an alarm. I learned all that kind of stuff, how to do all those things. I was at a meeting and I saw her and had to have her, and I prayed for her and I got her. And I only had to pay alimony for 5 years and then child support for another 12, right? So, it's like the way it is. And, I'd done anything for her. I had to have her. And even though I knew she wasn't, it wasn't right, it wasn't the right deal. But, when she divorced me, and I'm one of those ones that was, I was never going to make a move. I'd rather stay in chaos than upset the apple cart. And she divorced me, thank God. But at that time, I was 20 years sober, and I thought, how could this happen to me? And it just devastated me. And then I realized, I really wasn't that spiritually fit. I really wasn't working the program that well. I really didn't have a higher power. And I think one of the key things that you can that I found in AA is that when I learned to turn it over and get comfort from it, then I had, that's the whole key. Now, why I don't do that at all times, I don't know, I love that Herbert Spencer one, it's like nothing will keep you in everlasting ignorance than contempt prior to investigation. I prefer ignorance, I guess, because I'd rather be ignorant than take the time to listen to what you have to say, to learn what it is that I need to be doing, kind of stuff. And I think in that case, they're talking about spirituality, it's like find a God as you understand him. But you know, but we're, most of us are agnostics or atheists at the time when we come in, that we're not willing to even listen to that part, and we, you know, so it's just my opinion there, right? And so I got divorced. I was crazed. I thought I was never going to find another gal. And finally, after about 4 years, but I had two beautiful children from that, and I finally, I just kind of turned it over. After about 4 years, it took me about 4 years of a lot of pain to see what my part, you know, what my part was in it, and turn it over. And then I made a little list, right? You know what I wanted, and I said, you know, I'd like to find a, you know, I'll be a good dad, a good AA, you know, and a good employee, you know, kind of thing. And then I said, and, you know, there's always an and or a but. But if you happen to run across a gal who's not in childbearing years or, you know, not live too far away from Santa Barbara and no kids, I'd really like that. And, you know, so kind of finishes with that. But I was at an AA party for Vince Yo. See, Derek, I'm happy Derek's here because I can throw all these names. And then I just look at Derek, him, and he just nods. So... you guys are so lucky to have him here, huh? So, you know, so I went to this party and I looked across the room, and there she was, and you know, that arc, like only an AA can have, you know, from, you know, for another AA from across the room, and so you know, I asked her out, and she goes, I live in Santa Barbara. She goes, I live in LA. You know, hope you don't mind. I go, shit, I love the drive, you know. And so I went down. I was actually going to John Ackerlin's 50-year party or something. And, you know, so I was coming back. And so we went out, and she spilled her drink, you know, her water in my lap and talked my ear off for 3 hours. And I thought, God, this is it. You know, I mean, she's the woman for me. And then it turned out that she had two kids, and she was totally in childbearing years, and so we kind of bonded the kids, and I went out and did one, you know, got the other thing taken care of, and we've been married now for 15 years, and you know what, we got an AA marriage, and we both appreciate each other's programs and, you know, stuff like that. Sometimes we go to the same meeting. A lot of times we go to different meetings and stuff. But when, you know, I go, hey, I got to go Saturday night. She goes, okay, you know, whatever, you know, what do you need at Trader Joe's, you know, or whatever. You know, it's like we just do what we do, and you know, and we got a great marriage, and you know, we put a lot of effort into it and stuff like that. But you know, I'm just lucky. I also you know, what's funny is when I got here, I lived in a one room place, kind of no bigger than you know, this half of the room here or whatever, with just a bed and a Mr. Coffee, and I used to sit on the edge of the bed staring into my shoes and thinking, God, if I just had a wife and kids and a car and a nice job and a house, you know, everything would be okay, right? And then, you know, today I was, you know, staring into my shoes and thinking, you know, my car, I need, you know, it's like I need a smog on the car and we need to paint the house, and it's like, and you know, the kids are driving me crazy, and I was just thinking, shit, I wish I had a one room place where I could just go to and get away from all this. And you know, and the funny thing is when you, for me, when I got sober, all I wanted was those things, but what I didn't realize what comes with all those is responsibility and accountability and all the things that I didn't have out there, and you can't get until you've got that kind of stuff. And you know, and I had to learn, you know, I had to learn how to be responsible in here, and you know, to get that stuff and to have a kind of a, you know, to have a comfortable life, you know, kind of thing. So you know, I have you know, I've been pretty blessed. I had worked a lot of kind of funny jobs. I did automotive jobs and stuff like that, and I blew a knee out, and then I couldn't do that anymore, and I tried cleaning pools and shit and couldn't figure out how to do the chemicals. But a friend of mine called me up and said, hey, you got a job selling VW parts. Do you want to go? And I said, no, I just gotten fired from a job. I was just going to collect unemployment. But I was sober and was a guy in AA, right? And I saw him talking to my sponsor at the meeting, you know, kind of stuff. And you know how a lot of times you think, oh, well, they're talking about me. but you're really just, you know, self-obsessed, but except for that time. And, you know, so he's going, oh, I got a great job for Matt. He won't even go and apply. And, you know, and my, and fortunately, I've always had sponsors who weren't afraid to hurt my feelings, you know, or, you know, they were always, would always tell me what they really thought, you know, or, you know, they'd always challenge me to do better. And so my sponsor just said, you know what, you will go and apply, out of, you know, consideration to Claude. And I went out there and applied, and I got the job. I was selling VW parts. And the great, 35, this is, and that was 37 years ago. And the great thing about that job is it, you know, it was like all just numbers, you know, 111, 141, 165A, throw-out bearings and, you know, pushrod tubes and the ball joints and stuff like that, and all easy numbers to remember and all easy words to abbreviate, you know, so I never really had to do that. And I learned how to read. Reading Edgar Rice Burroughs books, you know, Tarzan and John Carter on Mars. And, you know, and the funny thing about that is they just made a movie, you know, about, I don't know, a couple of years ago, they made a John Carter on Mars. I thought, oh, fantastic. I loved all of those books. And so I went to the movie, I got my popcorn, I sit down and I look around, there's nobody in the movie, you know, nobody else read those books, I guess, or they hadn't read them for 20, you know, for 30 years, you know, so nobody who knew who John Carter was. But I learned, and I remember reading Tarzan books and then sitting in the meetings and sitting in the back there and thinking, I wonder if I could swing out over, you know, go, you know, kind of going across these, you know, the fans. You know, I mean, I would do those kind of things, but it just, you know, I learned how to read, basically, and now I can read well enough where if I get a new guy to sit down at my table, and, you know, we go over, you know, paragraphs and try to get the big book through them, right? So I've had that job, and I've been everything at that job, from the original operator and order desk to, you know, to VP of sales, to director of sales, to in charge of special projects, and that's kind of what I do now. And I'm kind of put in the pasture, but I've been blessed with work, and you know, I applied what I learned here. I learned to practice these principles in all my affairs, to do them there, and to treat the people there. You know, what's funny is our fellow employee, my fellow employees and my customers all want to just get, you know, slapped on the back and ask, you know, how are you doing? And it's going to be okay. And, you know, nice to see you and that kind of stuff. And I always, you know, I learned to treat the people at the office the same way I would a new guy, you know, kind of stuff, you know. So, I guess what I've learned here in AA, you know, it's kind of funny that I've learned that, you know, I've been obsessed with everything. I still have an obsessive, you know, compulsive, you know, I love old Don Locke always talks about, you know, now my biggest problem is putting the plug in the fork, you know, But, you know, I've been obsessed with anything worth doing, you know. I mean, whether it was, you know, drugs or alcohol or sex or gambling or ESPN or Haagen-Dazs ice cream or ESPN. Did I say ESPN already? You know, any of that kind of stuff. The only thing that I really ever learned to work to moderation was the steps, you know, kind of thing. And, you know, kind of stuff. So I do try to practice them. And I got sober on May 27th, 1973. I got 40 years. I'm almost 41. I'm 62 years sober, or 62 years alive, 40 years sober. And, you know, I have been blessed. And the thing I think that keeps me coming back is the fact that I still get young guys in my life, and I still, you know, there's still the spark there. I still find comfort when I come to these rooms. You know, I mean, I like the idea of being a free spirit, but I love the structure of AA and the fact that it's as loose as it is, but there's structure there. They number the steps for me, you know, to keep it simple, and, you know, and the traditions. And I try to just, adhere to that stuff. So, you know, that's really what I've done. I've been blessed in AA with everything that I've been given, and pretty much enjoyed the ride most of the time when I choose to. And I that's the other thing, is I've been given the options. I'm in charge of my own destiny as long as I'm willing to turn it over. So, with that, thanks, and thanks for having me.
Wow, great talk. Let's have another round of applause for Matt. Okay, so now we're